The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anoushka Astana. As Theresa May prepares to give her biggest speech on Brexit yet, enter Boris Johnson with a list of demands published in a way that clearly undermines her leadership.
Are you still talking about this article?
Meanwhile, Labour prepares for its annual conference, and Jeremy Corbyn gets set to usher through party rule changes to make it easier for the next leader to also come from his wing of the party. So, 2 years into his leadership, is he finally in full control of Labour? Joining me to discuss it all, Guardian columnists Gabby Hinsliff and Paul Mason, and Richard Angel, director of the centrist Labour pressure group Progress. But first, it landed with a thud on the Downing Street doorstep on Saturday morning. 4,000 words of pure Boris spread across the pages of the Daily Telegraph on Brexit, leadership and making Britain great again. All timed to give the Prime Minister a major headache ahead of her speech in Florence on Friday. More of that later. But first, I'm joined on the phone by Sonia Purnell, a biographer of Boris. Sonia, Boris is asking, why all the fuss? But he knew exactly what he was up to, didn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, the whole idea that Boris Johnson makes gaffes and things is to misunderstand the man. All these things are planned very carefully. I mean, it did read like it'd been rushed off in the back of the plane on the way back from the Caribbean. It may well have been written there, but that doesn't mean to say that he didn't know exactly what he was doing. He has been sort of rather written off of late. Even the Spectator was saying, where is Boris? Why don't we hear from him anymore? And I think this is his way of getting back into the headlines, and it certainly worked in that way. Of course, he got into trouble with the UK Statistics Authority for coming up with this totally erroneous £350 million a week figure. And that was getting a little bit troublesome for him. Even some of his supporters were uncomfortable about him having sort of public fight with such an august buddy. And so the next thing we know is that so-called friends are saying that he's about to resign unless Theresa May sort of does exactly what he wants her to do in her Florence speech. But then, of course, that's gone away as well because he tends to bottle these things and he's bottled it again.
But would you suggest that those so-called friends might have been the great man himself?
Well, I've been around long enough to know that friends of most often means the great man himself. And, I've seen Boris in action. I've known him for a very long time. I used to work with him many years ago in Brussels. We were there together for the Telegraph. I kind of know what makes Boris tick. I've seen him, in action for many years. And this is sort of classic Boris strategy. So, I'm pretty certain that was the great man himself.
OK, well, I really want to understand a bit more about the psychology of Boris Johnson. He is certainly an interesting man. I mean, he was so on the fence about Brexit that he literally wrote two articles, one in favour of Brexit, one in favour of Remain, ready to be published in The Telegraph. How has he gone from that kind of considered, central position that just tipped him over the edge to the Leave campaign to basically being the poster boy for hard Brexit?
Well, I think, the clue lies in the title to my book, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. This is all about ambition. What is going to play best for Boris? So, of course, a month before the referendum, he was seen to be totally EU. And in fact, when I worked with him all those years ago, even then, he was writing very critical stuff about the EU, but privately was very sympathetic to the great project. So I think every step that he makes is nothing to do with conviction or ideas or beliefs or ideology. It's all about what will further Boris Johnson's career. Well, right now, he clearly thinks that by becoming the Brexit hard man, the Brexit poster boy, that's going to be the way that's going to most likely deposit him in number 10. But yeah, as I said before, he quite often sort of bottles it when it actually comes to the crunch moment. So I don't think it's by any means definite that he's going to end up with what he wants.
And isn't this quite a dangerous strategy if where he wants to end up is number 10? Because some might argue that the Conservatives face an existential threat with the fact that young people are so much more likely to vote for the Labour Party. In his article, Boris Johnson accused young people of having split allegiances, and he's going for a type of Brexit that is much more heavily supported by an older demographic. I don't quite get the strategy.
I mean, it's interesting that, and that may well have been a mistake, because in the old days, he always very carefully cultivated young people. I remember sort of going to various universities, and they were all rather in love with Boris Johnson, or at least the idea of Boris Johnson. But I guess at the moment, what he's focused on, and I think this is quite revealing, is trying to become prime minister. Now, what does he need? He needs the support of Tory activists. How old are Tory activists? Well, they're pretty ancient, actually. They don't tend to be people at university. So he will have made a calculation that by being actually really grossly offensive and basically accusing young people of being traitors, that he's going to play into the hands of the sort of Tory activists that he's trying to curry favour with right now, the sort of Tory activists that he thinks might be able to deposit him a number 10.
And what chances do you think he has got of getting the keys?
Well, you know, politics is almost impossible to predict. Who would have predicted, you know, 2 years ago that we would be having this sort of conversation? I mean, never, ever write off Boris Johnson, or at least not yet. But I think most people will come to their senses. They will see that he has absolutely no regard for truth whatsoever, as we've seen of this £350 million thing. That, by the way, was not the first time the UK Statistics Authority has had a go at him. They certainly did when he was mayor as well. He's much more interested in the game of power rather than exercising power in any positive way. And I think in the end, quite a lot of people actually realise that. And so I certainly wouldn't bet the house on him ever becoming Prime Minister.
Okay, cutting. Thank you very much for your time, Sonia. Sonia Pennell there. Well, I'm joined now by Paul Mason, Richard Angel and Gabby Hinsliff. Gabby, Boris has had a strange hold over the party membership, but do you think some of that sheen might be wearing off?
I think it's probably divided people with this intervention. I mean, there are some Brexiters who feel it very much needed saying. Why shouldn't he be the one to say it? Why shouldn't the Foreign Secretary have an opinion? Theresa May did leave a vacuum and he stepped into it. But I think for those MPs who are increasingly coming to the conclusion that they'd rather lie down in the road in front of the Boris bulldozer than allow him to become Prime Minister, it really has emphasised that feeling that he is a liability, that it's always all about him, that it's always about him spotting an opportunity and leaping into it, that he can't stand to be not the focus of attention for 5 minutes, and that he can't cope with being bored. You know, it's almost like a toddler who has to, you know, jump up and down to get your attention when he seems to be left out of things.
But the members have loved him, haven't they?
They have. And I think he continues to be very popular and continues to be a big draw for constituency dinners and so on and so on and so on. But there is a sort of anti-Boris feeling as well. And I think people also haven't forgotten the mess that he made of his last tilt at the leadership when some members were quite alarmed by the speed with which it all collapsed. So it's not quite the sort of glorious love affair it was perhaps 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, you might not agree with the first half of my analogy, but I once recently described Boris as going from political honey, a man who had essentially won over Labour voters in London and, you know, ruled the city for 8 years, to political marmite. I mean, one of the most divisive people in the country. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn would relish the opportunity to go up against him?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, let's not hope for that situation, because for the sake of the country, it can't happen. I mean, the problem we've got here is that the closer the Conservative Party gets to spelling out what it actually wants from Brexit, the nearer it comes to splitting. It actually can't enumerate its demands to Europe because it can't agree on them. And that's why you get Boris Johnson leaping into the void. But, I mean, we have to register, over and above the kind of entertainment value for political insiders, it's had a really damaging impact on the situation. The first is diplomatic. Leave aside Europe. Just think about our person in Havana, our person in Kenya. You know, they don't really know what to say to the governments they interface with, the diplomatic corps, about what Britain's position is now, because he's Foreign Secretary. And there was in that article a really stupid attack on so-called transnational consciousness. And I mean, the words were basically an attack on the very concept of the European Union and all other transnational institutions, like, for example, the Spanish state, which is currently disintegrating. Boris says transnational consciousness is inimical to, you know, national sovereignty. And I think, you know, he's really, really confused things there. And then on top of that, the Europeans are just laughing at us. They're saying, you can't decide what you want. And that is true.
They may be laughing at us, Richard, but at the same time, we have voted for Brexit. Is there anything wrong with Boris providing a optimistic look at what might happen?
As a private citizen, of course there's not, but as a member of a government that's supposed to be acting together and fighting for our best interests. I mean, the bit the negotiation is showing is how effective the EU is at fighting for its member states and getting its interests across. I was pleased they were doing it on our behalf until recently, and it looks like they're better at doing it on behalf of their member states than the current government is on behalf of doing it on just behalf of one member state.
And Gabby, I mean, he describes this as a loyal piece that was basically backing government policy. But it's pretty clear if you talk to people around Boris that, A, he's worried about what Theresa May is going to say in Florence. And B, by bringing back up that really controversial £350 million, he knew that it was going to cause this sort of reaction. How much does this undermine the Prime Minister?
There was arguably a legitimate reason for doing it, which was, you know, to step into a debate that was in danger of drifting and all this bit. But you don't do that on the eve of the Prime Minister doing what she's been encouraged to do, which is make the position clearer. If all you really want is to clarify the position, you don't do that, you know, 3 days before the Prime Minister is about to clarify the position. You just undermine her. Because now almost anything she says is going to be seen in the light. It's going to be sort of marked against Boris's benchmarks that he's set for her. So if she says anything remotely upbeat about Britain post-Brexit, which presumably she was going to say anyway, people will nod and say, oh, you know, that's because Boris called for her to be more sunny and more optimistic. And if she says anything remotely hardball, oh, yeah, well, she's just keeping Boris on side and happy.
But of course, she won't be able to sack him, and nor could she sack, nope, for example, Philip Hammond, who'll also be watching her in Florence. Just explain to us why that is, Gabby.
Because she doesn't have the authority anymore. I mean, since the election was almost as much about getting a mandate to negotiate with her own cabinet as it was about getting a mandate to negotiate with the EU. If you're a strong leader, if you've just had a fantastic election and enhanced your majority and everyone thinks you're amazing, you can say to the rest of cabinet, who all completely profoundly disagree about the form of Brexit, you know, well, this is what we're doing. And I say jump and you say how high. If you are, you know, effectively serving only at the pleasure of those MPs, you could be booted out at any moment, but they've agreed to let you stay on. You don't have the authority to do that. She can't sack anybody. She can't physically, can't possibly please all of them. And so over summer, she's kind of managed that by not siding publicly with any faction or another. But you obviously can't keep doing that forever.
OK, well, we will get into that Theresa May speech later on. But before that, let's look at Labour. This week, Jeremy Corbyn secured a victory at Labour's ruling body, the NEC, to make it easier for his successor to come from the left of the party. Now, we know that Jeremy Corbyn only just secured enough MPs nomination to run himself originally, and he wouldn't have secured enough MPs in a second leadership battle had he been forced to find them. But in fact, he went on to massively win that leadership battle. Now, the NEC has agreed to reduce the percentage of the parliamentary party and MEPs needed to nominate a leadership candidate from 15% to 10%, not quite as far as some wanted, to 5%. And it will almost certainly now be passed at conference. Now, Richard, you've been against this change, but you know, you can understand, can't you, why members might want to see something like this. After all, MPs told us he was unelectable. They suggested that his election pitch would be the second longest suicide note in history, or some of them did. And in fact, it turned out to be a bit closer to Attlee than to Foote, if you look at the results. The MPs were wrong. Isn't it right to drop that threshold?
Well, when the leadership is so secure in their position and we have an opportunity with the Tories on the rope, we should be talking policy to the British public. And it's hard enough to get the media to talk about policy as it is. When there's process available, they'll take that. And the current leadership, who are the new establishment in the Labour Party, they've got control of the NEC, the Conference Arrangements Committee and all the other levers now, have decided to go for not just rule changes this year that are going to divide people. They've gone to have a review that will announced before next year's conference with more rule changes, the one afterwards. So at a time in which all of our focus should be on taking down a Tory government, we've got three conferences on rule changes and a political secretary not planning for Downing Street, but planning for her faction to deliver in the party. That seems to me to be truly absurd.
Although somebody said to me yesterday, these rule changes might in fact make it easier for a centrist candidate to get on the ballot.
who knows? I can't predict the future. But I think the point of the leadership election is it's not about a poll of members. It's about picking the next prime minister. And they have to do that to be able to corral their colleagues. Because when it comes down to how you have a government, it's not the most conscientious voice on the green benches. It's the person who can replace the Treasury benches.
And Paul, there is some truth in that. When there was that coup against Jeremy Corbyn, it was partly because of mismanagement internally in Westminster, something that only MPs can see.
Well, look, for us, on the radical left of the Labour Party, these constitutional changes are a means to an end. And the end is a radical Labour government, which all its MPs will back when its manifesto gets turned into legislation, and a social movement that can provide, you know, the face-to-face, grassroots level, networked action that you're going to need to transform. You see, it's very easy to give 1% or more pay rise to NHS workers. It's very difficult to unionise Starbucks and unionise Amazon and McDonald's. And for that, we need the two parts of the Labour machine, as it were, which have always been Parliament and mass action, need to be, I think, more kind of connected and responsive to each other. So I welcome this 10% compromise, for example. I welcome the fact, actually, you could say, well, we're going to have three conferences about democratising the party. Tony Blair had how many? Ten conferences about undemocratising the party.
Well, I don't remember a conference about undemocratising the party.
Well, I remember one. It was the one where they abolished Clause 4.
I'd and like the other to see nine of the ten were?
Well, they abolished every Clause 4, they replaced
every single
it.
One rooted Blair's power more and more in that sofa cabinet that killed 600,000 Iraqi civilians.
Okay, Gabby.
I don't think conference did that. I mean, I think the reason MPs matter in the selection of candidates, whether in any party, not just the Labour Party, is two reasons. First is because they're the people who see the leader day to day, who work with them closely, who know what they're like in a way that you can't quite from the outside. But secondly, because they have the connection to the voters, and because you hopefully, with a spread of MPs, you know, from different kinds of seats, different parts of the country, different traditions, you get a spread. They should be, and I know they don't always, but when they're choosing a leader, they should be reflecting what their constituents and what the voters want.
But were
the problem is
that
handing more power to the membership is that you do put the membership in opposition to voters.
But you know, the MPs had real conviction that Corbyn was a disaster. So to that extent, weren't they wrong?
Some of them had that conviction. Some of them were very prepared to, you know, kind of to let things happen and see what happened. I think they were wrong about how unelectable he was, absolutely. But I don't think because some MPs were wrong once about how unelectable he was, I mean, technically they weren't wrong that he was going to lose. But, you know, because some MPs were wrong once, is that a reason to exclude MPs from the decision forevermore? I'm not sure that it is. You know, MPs have picked the wrong candidate in plenty of party leadership elections in the past, but they've also picked quite a lot of right candidates.
Perhaps, but 10% isn't excluding them completely, is it, Richard?
It means a future leadership election could have nine candidates, that the choice of somebody's eighth preference could be the one that delivers Labour's candidate for Prime Minister. And it means that it becomes a kind of minority pursuit rather than a serious display to the voters that we're serious about becoming the Prime Minister.
Can I ask you a question, Paul? You talk about the radical left and your desire for what you would do if you control both the Labour Party and the government. Was the 2017 Labour manifesto radical enough?
No. Well, look, I think it was very radical fiscally, in the sense that it was so radical that I think next time if we repeat it, we'll get, you know, I think probably likely the financial markets will be more edgy at the prospect of a $50 billion transfer from the rich to the poor than they were, because they know it's a possibility. I think at the level of projecting a future vision for a mixed economy of the state, the market and the non-market, that is collaboration, cooperatives, it wasn't radical enough, and I'd like to see it more forward-looking. I think this conference, there will be time in this conference where we are talking about what technological change, its impact on jobs, how to redesign the labour market, how to redesign the welfare system. I mean, the problem is out of power. You know, everybody around this table and in this podcast knows how small Labour's structures are. I mean, the teams, the policy formation teams are actually really small, and therefore, with a bit of time, I think a future manifesto should be able to hook in that kind of sceptical business centrist voter to a positive vision of the future in the way that it possibly didn't this time.
And Richard, are your worries about a successor from the same wing of the party as Jeremy Corbyn more to do with electability or more to do with the politics?
The politics. I think that there's a difference in vision about the kind of country we want to have. And that's what we've been trying to conduct in a way that's hopefully about those ideas. And I think that's there's still a battle of ideas to be had. Because Jeremy Corbyn was on the losing side for 30 years, he didn't go away. And we hope to have that.
You're going to be sitting there for 30 years waiting.
Maybe.
Can this party work together?
Absolutely.
Can you all be part of the same party?
Absolutely.
This,
I went to 30 seats in this election.
There is room for Richard Angel and Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, there has been for the last 120 years, so I'm sure there will be going forward. That's
okay. Gabby, this is a really big moment for Jeremy Corbyn. Clearly, he did defy some expectations in that election, although he did not win. And clearly, this week will be about saying, can they move on to the next step? What do you think he needs to do to show that he is a prime minister in waiting?
I think answer some of the big questions. What I'd like to see is a clear answer once and for all to where he stands on Brexit, what he wants, you know, this kind of dance Labour's been doing where it's showing a Remain face to some people and a Leave face to others. You know, I don't think that can go on. I really need to see some clarity. The other thing that I think he needs to set, probably the nagging doubt in a lot of people's minds, what kept them from voting Labour when they might have done last time, there was a nagging thing. Well, there's partly a fear that he wasn't going to win anyways. What's the point? That will have been resolved by the result. But the other is a sort of nagging fear, I think, probably about competence, about people who liked the ideas but sort of weren't quite sure that it was all going to work, weren't sure about him as a person, weren't sure about the quality of someone's shadow cabinet, weren't sure, it didn't look like they were ready to be in charge. Could you imagine Jeremy Corbyn sort of chairing a Cobra meeting, for example? You know, and those kind of things, I think those are the kind of things that he needs to assuage people's doubts about.
Could you imagine him chairing a Cobra meeting, Gabby?
Honestly, no.
Well, I've seen him chair pretty feisty meetings of his own team.
That's very different from...
No, when under attack, I under attack from his own people.
And when were you in the room for shadow cabinet meetings?
I defended him as a Labour Party member, and I've seen them fight in a very organised way in the most adverse conditions. And I think Corbyn, coming through that 2016 challenge, did come out a bit a stronger leader, i.e. in himself. Now, I think he needs to carry on growing. And I think he needs to see, for me, it's not about competence. Competence in government should come from a mixture of politicians and civil servants. And right now, the challenge is, how is Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, etc., going to take over the relative departments and offices of state and run them competently with civil servants who are prepared to enact the most radical manifesto for many years? So that's the first thing. But I actually think a bigger issue is there. On the doorsteps I went on were all places we should have won and lost, and there were places like Bolton West or Plymouth North. And for me, it is national security. I'm on that wing of the Labour left that describes itself as neo-Bevanite. I want us to abolish neoliberalism. I want us to do a radical left economic manifesto. But I want to do what Alexis Tsipras did in Greece in 2015. We say to the generals and the police and the security establishment, what do you need? We'll give it to you. You know, there's got to be no doubt in the electorate's mind whatsoever that we represent continuity on national security.
Okay, and just last question, and then you can come back on that. But Richard, let me just ask you a question on that as well. Wasn't one of the big things in the election that was quite surprising to people that Jeremy Corbyn laid out his arguments on foreign policy after, you know, a very, very serious terror attack, and it did not put voters off?
Well, if you look, there was two things on that. Firstly, what they leaked that they were going to say and what he actually said were very different. And if you read Tim Shipman's book, that some of it's coming out, is how moderate MPs and people like Andy Burnham and the leader in Manchester, Richard Lees, saved Jeremy Corbyn from his own instincts on how to politicise that situation and mastered him through to a much better outcome for that. So it wasn't, had he had dealt with that crisis the way he wanted to, he'd have had all of his candidates behind him and seriously politicised that event. And because of the interventions of moderate MPs and civic leaders, he was actually dissuaded from his own instincts on that. So that does bring back the worries that that Gabby has on those issues. But I want to come in on what Gabby said. He's absolutely got to choose on Brexit. And it seems to me he's caught between his Benite comrades and the Corbynite crowd. Is that those people who, you know, think that Tony Benn turning his grave would be the worst thing ever, are kind of secret Lexiters. But the people at Glastonbury that were cheering him on want a Remain future, and he's going to have to pick at some point.
Well, one key figure in achieving that compromise deal at Labour's NEC is the party chair, Ian Lavery, and he joins us now. You presumably were involved in achieving this compromise deal at the NEC, which will see the threshold for MPs reduced to 10%. Do you really want to go much further than that?
Well, let's take things a step at a time. Let we get this into the rule book before we even think about potentially changing it in the future. It's a great move forward. And a lot of people are suggesting that it might mean that we will have a lefty or someone of Jeremy Corbyn's ilk on the ballot paper. But you know, that's the democratic process which we should all be very proud of.
And are you determined that the succession should be in place for Jeremy to make sure that the members have another candidate of his ilk?
I think the 10% rule, the rule change will allow people from all sides of the party to put forward, not just anybody from the left. It'll allow people from the left, from the right, from the centrists to get as many names as they need to put themselves forward for the ballot. And again, that's part of the democratic process. We want openness, we want to change, and that's why we've come to this compromise of 10%.
Okay, great. And tell us what this conference is going to be all about.
This is going to be a wonderful conference. I've been going to conference all my adult life. And conference has changed dramatically over the years, where it used to be confrontational, then it became a little bit more stage managed. This time, for the first time, there's a decision being made, and we're prioritising CLP delegates, people from the cool face, basically, the shop floor, to encouraging them to participate in the conference more than they have been in the past. And that'll be on all the relevant issues facing people, people in different communities. So, listen, there's more people being applied for credentials for this year's conference than ever before. That's thousands and thousands and thousands want to be at this year's conference. It's fantastic, it really is, because other parties are looking at different ways and means of encouraging people to attend their conferences. We've got the opposite problem, and it's a wonderful problem to have, really.
Okay, just finally, Ian, I've got to ask you, presumably you might have attended a conference 20 years ago in 1997. How do you think this conference compares to the one I suspect you perhaps went to then, and how does this leader, Jeremy Corbyn, compare to his predecessor, Tony Blair?
Well, Tony Blair done the Labour Party under the guidance of Tony Blair done some wonderful things. We cannot ever forget that. The conference in 1997 was fantastic. It was pretty stage managed, mind. This time it'll be completely different. I think that this conference will have the biggest buzz with ordinary people, members of the Labour Party, than any conference I've ever attended before. The whole idea is to get more people involved in politics, people in the community, so they'll get away from this conference, they get into the communities, and they've got something to say to the people where they live. Campaign on behalf of the Labour government. We want to excite people, we want to enthuse people, and that's what this conference is all about. It's going to be fantastic. I promise you, this will be fantastic.
Ian Lavery there. Well, Theresa May will fly back from New York later, where she's been speaking at the UN General Assembly. On Friday, she's going to give perhaps the biggest speech of her premiership. In it, she'll set out a vision of a post-Brexit relationship with the EU. And she's chosen to make it in the Italian city of Florence, with all its symbolic trading history. Well, our own Heather Stewart is in New York with the Prime Minister. So, Heather, the Prime Minister has batted away Boris Johnson, but do we know what she's going to say on Friday? And has it changed as a result of his intervention?
Ha. Well, it's hard to know what's gone on behind the scenes. Certainly, people around the Prime Minister say nothing has changed. You remember that phrase? You know, she was always going to say something about the transitional deal. On Friday, she was never going to say anything that bound us into what people call an EEA-type arrangement or alternatively a Swiss-style arrangement, some form of very close relationship. This is the thing that really worries Johnson. So you know, there are people around Downing Street saying, no, we were never going to say something that strong. But others say, actually, you know, Johnson has kind of moved them slightly. I don't know. Someone in one minister I was talking to last night was saying they thought it was more about a kind of psychodrama being played out, you know, solo psychodrama for the foreign secretary rather than anything more significant than that. But it certainly made Friday into a very big moment.
And interestingly, you've just travelled with the Prime Minister to Canada and then to New York. This trip has now been totally overshadowed by the Foreign Secretary's intervention. What was her mood on the plane on the way over there?
Well, actually, she seemed rather upbeat, very quite chatty when she came out to talk to the group of journalists and, you know, quite determined in getting her message across and you know, perhaps not quite as wooden as she sometimes was during the campaign. It felt rather, she didn't seem terribly bothered by the Foreign Secretary's intervention, and she was rather keen to sort of bat it away. But nevertheless, her team certainly haven't been very pleased about the fact that the agenda has been totally dominated, not by the issues she wanted to talk about, modern slavery and the situation in Burma and so on, but by, you know, Johnson and this willy won't he resign.
And just describe to our listeners what it's like on the ground there for journalists. I mean, I saw that he was collared by a lift, all sweaty after a run. Are you all kind of running around like a pack seeking out Boris?
Yeah, there's definitely a certain amount of that. And there was a lot of yesterday, you know, what was the Prime Minister going to be at this drinks reception in the evening? Was Johnson going to be there too? You know, we were sort of quizzing her spokesman about, well, have they met? Will they meet? You know, they were staying in the same hotel. How would they not manage to sit down and have a chat with each other? You know, again, it's just a kind of horrendous distraction for a team who'd hoped to be talking about all kinds of sort of global issues, internet terrorism and all kinds of other things.
And one of the big worries for them, presumably, is this speech is all about trying to make sure we can now move on to the next stage of negotiations, move from talk about the divorce to talk about a future trade deal. If they have to rein in how conciliatory they are in this speech, is that going to damage the prospect of that?
Well, that's the risk. And they want to have made enough progress on the divorce deal to be able to move on to that next stage. And they need the support of EU leaders to do that. And clearly May was hoping to sort of offer enough of an olive branch to say, we're deadly serious about that. Let's move on. And, you know, part of their worry in watching Johnson's kind of actions unfold this week will be how that will have been viewed by other leaders. You know, to what extent can she commit her government to a very close future relationship if it's very clear that even within her own cabinet there are people who've got deep concerns about that?
Okay, just quickly, last question, because I know it's a grueling trip. You even did a 23-hour day. You're a hero. Quick question, should she sack Boris Johnson?
Well, she's going to have to resolve this issue in cabinet somehow. So one wonders whether if she doesn't sack him now, perhaps she'll have to sack him sometime soon. It's certainly a pretty extraordinary display of disloyalty from a senior cabinet figure.
Fantastic. Heather, I'll let you go back on the Boris hunt. Thank you very much for joining us. So, Gabby, how difficult is this Florence speech for the Prime Minister? Is it the most important of her premiership?
I think she's probably going to have several most important speeches of her premiership before it's over. But this one is really critical in doing two things. First of all, it needs to make clear, obviously, Brexit policy has changed over summer. We know that it's changed since the election, but we just don't know how. There's been a lot of internal arguments, so she needs to spell out precisely where we are to us. Secondly, the point of doing it in Florence was presumably to do something belatedly that a lot of people felt she should have done from the start, which is to say, look, we're leaving the EU, but we're not leaving Europe. You know, we still have an international outlook. We still have friends and allies here. Look, you know, I still feel comfortable making this speech in an Italian city. And that, I think, that sort of warmth almost that she needs to show towards
Europe and Europe's people is probably going to be the hardest thing for Theresa May to pull off. As we know, warmth is not exactly her strong suit.
And Richard, one thing that's going to be interesting is seeing both Boris Johnson and Philip Hammond in the audience. I mean, if you believe all the commentary around it, one of them wants EEA minus and one of them wants CETA plus. How on earth can she please both those men?
I'm not sure that she can, but it shouldn't be about the men in her cabinet. It should be about the country, and she should be trying to find a way to bring people together. And it seems to me, in a country where it was finely balanced, where there were promises made by the Leave people that we'd still be in the single market, that the EEA, the kind of Norway system, but with our own British exceptions, could be a way forward for the country. And that would be the right thing, rather than debating between whether you're Switzerland minus or Canada plus. The reality is the Canada plus thing is more is going to turn Britain into a Singapore-style economy, and that's what Boris and Michael Gove really want for us, and I think we have to do everything we can to stop that happening.
And Paul, is there any chance of stopping any of this happening? I mean, the Tories are not going to give Labour an election before 2022.
Well, as soon as they have to concretise any proposal into a legislative, you know, proposal, they'll fall. I mean, that's the gamble I would take. But looking at Friday's speech, I think let's hope she doesn't begin it "Welcome to Chianti Shire," or you know, let's hope that she does express real warmth towards the interlocutors, because we need to do it. On the content, the Europeans believe they're going to be offered 18 billion, which is not enough as a dowry, and that's for access to the single market. If it is
in transition,
yeah. If it is something based on this Legatum Institute proposal of a kind of new version of EFTA without free movement. This is effectively what I think she'll propose. It'll be rejected out of hand because the other EFTA members don't want it. But at least it's a gambit. At least it's something on paper, which is, I mean, I can't even now believe the incompetence of going through the whole 18-month period, what is it, 15-month period, without a proposal.
Now, finally this week, the Liberal Democrats have been in Bournemouth gathering for their annual conference under their new leader, Vince Cable. After pitching themselves as the anti-Brexit party in June's election, they made only modest gains after 2015's near wipeout. So where does the party go now? Our reporter Jessica Elgott went along to find out.
So it's been beautiful sunny weather in Bournemouth, and some of the activists have even been down to the beach to write a huge Brexit exit in the sands down here at Lib Dem conference. Brexit is the key issue here. That's because there's a huge influx of new members. And that's not necessarily because Vince Cable has such a dedicated following. These are people who want to oppose Brexit, full stop. A conference or a heated debate in the auditorium a couple of days ago between Lib Dems on this very subject. And it's not between Leavers and Remainers. It's people who are anti-Brexit and people who are very, 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 very anti-Brexit. And some of them want to change Lib Dem policy even further to pledge to overturn the referendum result, full stop. And those people were defeated, and the party's going to stick with its current policy, which is to hold a referendum on the terms of whatever Brexit deal we get, with the option then to stay in the EU. The danger for the Lib Dems is that this issue dominates everything. In his speech, Vince Cable said he didn't want to be UKIP in reverse. He wanted to be a serious party of government. He even said he wanted to be the Prime Minister, and he wanted to make radical policies, not just on Brexit, but on economic reform, on the environment, and even, yes, student debt. So I've been talking to some new MPs, some party veterans and some activists, to ask what they made of the election result and their hopes for the Vince era.
My name's Jane Riekerman. I'm a member of Bath for Europe, which is actually a cross-party political group, but I'm actually here as a Lib Dem. This is my very first. I'm one of those Lib Dem newbies who joined only 6 months ago, literally as a response to the referendum. My main focus on coming here was to find out basically if the party is just, as far as I'm concerned, on message with regard to Brexit. Personally, I would just love to tear up Article 50, but I realise that that's not pragmatic or realistic. And I think the policy of the second referendum, basically building some kind of a consensus, is probably the most sensible solution. I'm part of the team that wrote Exit from Brexit on the Beach, so that probably tells you about where I stand on all this.
So I'm sitting here with Leila Moran. She's one of the new Lib Dem MPs. What's it like, your first conference as an MP?
Yeah, it's been amazing. It kind of feels like coming home to the family and celebrating the fact that you won, and definitely a new kid on the block feel. I've been doing loads and loads of fringes, and taking the time to say thank you to everyone who helped me. There hasn't really been much time since I've been elected. Feet haven't really touched the ground, so it's nice to come back and celebrate.
What's the atmosphere like at this conference? Because last year, I think it felt like there was a real huge momentum behind the idea of opposing Brexit. And since then, we've had a general election where there was some successes in some places like your seat. But otherwise, the advance has been quite small. And how can you keep up that same sense of momentum? Or is there, you know, maybe it's slightly a bit more lacklustre this year?
Yeah, I don't agree with it being lacklustre, actually. It's the largest number of members that have ever come to any Lib Dem conference. And a lot of them joined in the last 2 years off the back of that, first the 2015 defeat, then the referendum. And actually, we picked up 20,000 new members during the last election. What it does feel is a bit more, rather than frenetic as it was last time, it now feels a bit more mature.
Hi, I'm Dick Newby. I'm the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the House of Lords.
What do you think Vince needs to... what kind of message do you think Vince needs to send to motivate people who might have had a very tiring, bruising election campaign? They're facing another 5 years. They're facing Brexit, which most people are opposed to.
Sure.
What does he need to say to motivate those people to keep them fighting?
Well, I think what you need is you need to know what your destination is in politics and what your strategy is. And the thing is, we now have a short-term anti-Brexit strategy, which is a focus for a lot of folk. For people who are fighting local elections next year, it's largely, as always, an anti-government strategy because of the failings of government, and in particular, failings satisfactorily to fund services that affect people at local level.
My name is Christine Iredale. I'm a councillor for the Kirklees Metropolitan Council, and it's my first time here in the conference in Bournemouth. I'm really enjoying it. I'm finding it very, very entertaining as well as being educational. I've heard Vincent speak, Tim, and I've done some training. And in general, I am thoroughly enjoying myself. I liked Tim. I liked Nick. I like Vince, you know. So I'm looking forward to Vince's speech this afternoon.
I'm ready to take our message out to the country. And I ask you to join me on the journey as we together take the Liberal Democrats back to government.
Well, that is all we have time for this week. My thanks to Gabby Hinsliff, Paul Mason, Richard Angel, Sonia Pennell, Heather Stewart and Jessica Elgott. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thank you for listening.